Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. I appreciate you listening in on this Martin Luther King Day. The Political Junkie joins me at 10 this hour. We're in-depth on the rise of right-wing nationalists in Europe. On a recent flight, I sat next to a Dutch couple who just arrived from Amsterdam and were beginning 3 weeks of vacation in California. We talked about the sights that they shouldn't miss while they were here. And then the conversation turned quickly to the inauguration of Donald Trump, the election that would soon be held in the Netherlands, and the popularity of the far-right Freedom Party and its leader, Geert Wilders. They worried, they told me, about the Trump effect on Dutch voters. If it could happen here, it could happen there. Wilders in Holland, Marine Le Pen in France, far-right candidates in Austria, Greece, Sweden, and Germany are all riding a wave of strong support, and many of them are quite vocal about their opposition to immigration and to Islam. Today, a discussion about what this means for Europe, its EU coalition, its immigration policies, and its relationship with the United States. If you have concerns or questions, perhaps you travel frequently to Europe, you've been following the news of the various candidates and campaigns there, we welcome your questions this morning. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. I'm on Twitter at Carrie NPR. Our guest this hour, Mary Curtin, is a diplomat in residence at the Humphrey School after spending 25 years in the Foreign Service. And she's with me in the studio. Welcome back. Really good to have you here.
Thanks. It's great to be back.
Robert Kelly is with us. He's an assistant professor at the School of International Service at American University, where he's researching the changing role of the diplomat. And he joins us today from Washington. And Robert, I'm going to ask you about your research a little later in the conversation, but welcome. It's good to have you here.
Happy to be here.
Mary, I think it's important to understand what nationalism looks like in Europe and how it might differ from the way we would perceive it here in the United States. Where are the differences?
I think that some of the differences are related to the history, which means that in Europe, the nation states that are there are somewhat or largely based on sort of an ethnic identity. So to be French, there's a concept of what it means to be Dutch, that to be Polish. It includes probably a racial element of that, that if you are Polish, then you are not, say, a Somali immigrant. And in the United States, I think that we have seen a rise, say, of white nationalism among the support for Donald Trump. But American nationalism also has often included a lot of new immigrants and is related more to an idea of the political idea of the United States rather than, I think, the sort of national or the ethnic linguistic origin of European nationalism.
Robert, given what Mary just said, if you held the remarks, some of the remarks that Donald Trump made during the campaign up next to some of the things that Wilders is saying or Marine Le Pen is saying in France, would you find some common threads? How much similarity would actually be there?
Well, I think that the rhetoric that you're hearing from Donald Trump and the rhetoric that you're hearing from some of these candidates in the EU are similar in the sense that they are trying to harness a kind of a discontent, a general discontent and a kind of apathy for certainly for elites that have been running the countries up to this point, also for a disenchantment with the economic model and the deal that has been presented to these populations of what the good life will produce. But I think you're right that there is, or your suggestion is right, that there is some common there are some common features between the two discourses. But I would also agree with what's just been said about the difference between the ethnic, the variation that we're seeing in the United States and the variations that we're seeing in the EU, where there is something quite different about the linguistic and ethnic identity that is being exploited, if you will, I think, and it's somewhat different here. I think what we're seeing in the United States, on the other hand, is really a widespread discontent, which is more decentralized and harder to harder to define.
So, Mary, do you, when Robert says we're seeing economic discontent, but you will see variations of that, is it an economic discontent here that comes from different sources? Like, our reason for economic discontent in this country looks different than the European discontent that's leading to the rise of these parties.
Mm-hmm. I think that there are differences. And again, you know, probably some common threads. So, for example, in Europe, in, say, Poland or France, there's a feeling that some people have been left out of the promise that the EU holds for people. So that you can see, for example, in the votes in Poland that led to the election of the nationalist government a little over a year ago, you see the same sort of red-blue divide that we have in the United States, where people in the cities, people who do a little bit better, people who have that education voted for the more centrist governments, people in the rural areas who had that anger that they had been left out. And the same was true in England on the Brexit,
vote. But I mean, I think we did a show not too long ago on the urban-rural divide. I think what you're saying would fit that.
Yeah. And so maybe the model is different. So, for example, in Poland, there was a decline, say, in industry after the fall of the Soviet state, you know, and the fall of the wall. But there was a rise in different types of economy, and some people benefited from that and some people did not. So that's a similarity where, say, in Minnesota, some people in the rural areas and smaller towns feel that somehow people in the Twin Cities are doing better than they are. But the other thing that's kind of, I think, similar is there are contradictions, whether in England or, you know, France or the United States, where people want some of the benefits that come from the current economic system. And certainly in Europe, Polish people want to go live in England to work there as they can under the EU. And on the other hand, people resent what they see as too much control from the government, even though it's that government that brings them the benefits. So there are contradictions.
I was going to say the contradictions, actually, there's a lot of contradiction embedded in the way I think people feel among the American electorate, too.
Yes. And so I think that's a similarity.
Let me grab a call here from Britta in Cottage Grove. Hey, Britta, what are you thinking about this?
Hi. So I've been listening this morning, and my question, you know, like we've seen so often and what you guys have mentioned on the show is that these things are happening in a wave. I'm wondering if we've seen anything like this before, perhaps with any other American presidents that have been elected or any other world leaders like that.
Robert, would you tackle that? And thanks for the question, Britta.
Yeah, it's a good question. You know, these periods where the United States goes through, you know, the normal way of looking at it is that the United States kind of goes through these waves, right, where they are sometimes feeling rather isolationist. And this isolationism is driven by a profound suspicion for what's going on around the world, a distrust for outsiders. And of course, globalization and the connections that the country might be forming abroad. I think that there's a really interesting parallel between now and what we saw at the beginning of the 20th century, where there were immigrants coming in mass. We had an economy that was really being driven by the Industrial Revolution. And I think populism at that point, we think back to some of the jingoism and the Yellow Scare, you know, like there was a widespread feeling, I think, in the United States that there were factors going on that were beyond their control and people coming in and that was unregulated and just too much. And so I do think, and that's just one example, but I do think that there have been other periods where the United States kind of waxes and wanes with its willingness to engage with the rest of the world.
Robert, Mary has mentioned Poland, and I wanted to bring up Germany here because I'm curious about how the way these parties express, you know, their principles differs between European country to European country. Because if I read a description of Germany's Alternative for Germany party, which is the right wing party that's rising there, they and their supporters are described as anti-liberal, anti-European, and, quote, against everything that is the norm.
Now, would we say the same thing, Robert, about someone like Marine Le Pen in France? Or are there some significant differences between the parties themselves?
Well, I think it is important to point out that before we get too swept up in the idea that there is something monolithic about all of these right-wing movements, to look very carefully at each country and where their sentiments are coming from, because they're not all the same. Mm-hmm. I think Le Pen has always been a fringe candidate in France, and it's just, I think, convenient and timely that she's experiencing a swell in support as the EU is under a huge amount of criticism and duress in every way. I mean, it's just being pummeled. The whole organization, the whole project, I think, is under a lot of strain. But if you go to Italy, for instance, you see that the party that was the so-called populist party, the Five Star Movement there, was not decidedly anti-immigrant. Mm-hmm. It drew from strains that were from the left, from the right. And one of the problems that I think it faced was that it had a hard time kind of coalescing all of that together into something, some kind of message that everyone could understand. So it is important to look at these contexts individually rather than to just suspect that Europe is just under, you know, a wave right now of anti-elitist, anti-immigrant sentiment.
This is a conversation, if you just tuned in, that is really speaking to what Robert Kelly, one of our guests, was just saying, is trying to understand the rise of nationalist parties. Some of them, as we're saying, anti-immigrant, some of them anti-Islam, some of them not, pulling from different elements in the political landscape in these countries. But there's been a lot of analysis about what happened here with the election with Donald Trump and some of the rhetoric that he employed during the campaign, how similar some of that sounds to some of these candidates in Europe, and trying to understand the differences, the commonalities within Europe of some of these parties, and what it means, what it says about geopolitics across the West today. Mary Curtin is one of our guests. She's a diplomat in residence at the Humphrey School. And Robert Kelly is with us, assistant professor at the School of International Service at American University. And I'm asking you, as you tune into the discussion, what kinds of questions, maybe, as I said, you travel to Europe, maybe you've been following a lot of this analysis about what the election of Donald Trump means here, the inauguration, of course, coming Friday, and then what that means among Europeans. And you have some observations or some questions about it. 800-242-2828, 651-227-6000. I'm on Twitter, at @CarrieMPR, and to Peter, listening in St. Paul. Hey, Peter, thanks for waiting. What question do you have about this or observation?
Yeah, I'm just curious to the guest's point of view on there's an interesting exchange between Germany and the incoming Trump administration where I found like kind of the narrative stories being broken where you have Trump who kind of rose on populism with a sense of isolationism. We don't know how that's going to go yet. And yet Germany responded for the criticism of the immigration problem in Europe by blaming the unilateral interventionism. They didn't reference the Bush administration, but that's clearly what they're pointing to in terms of messing up the Middle East and that following through to the following administration. And I just thought it was a very interesting juxtaposition mm-hmm. where all our narratives are kind of thrown out the door at the moment. And the other thing is I travel out to Scandinavia a lot, and it seems like these points of view tend to manifest themselves in the Scandinavian countries within their existing parties where they shift rather than having these alternative right-wing parties gain as much ground.
Oh, some really good points. Yeah. I want to talk about, I'm really glad you brought up Scandinavia and Sweden. So we'll get to that in a minute here, because Jimmy Åkesson's Swedish Democrats, there's some interesting rhetoric coming out of that. But Mary, to the first part of his question in this exchange going on between Trump and Germany and the sources, I guess, of what's happened there.
Well, I think what's really extraordinarily different, as with a lot about Donald Trump, is the way in which the differences and the arguments about what's happening and whose fault it is being played out so publicly. You know, among countries, there are always disagreements about what to do. And certainly there has for a long time in Europe been resentment over the sort of blowback from the Iraq War and you know, that was fairly openly discussed, but not in this way, not with these public recriminations. And as someone who was in the Foreign Service and who was a diplomat, to see this kind of conversation even before he's inaugurated does not, in my opinion, bode well for how we will go forward in looking at our relationship and the organizations, the EU and NATO, that have, despite their weaknesses, helped prevent war within Europe and build security and build economic strength for so long.
I want to ask you something about that, though, because I know it's probably not how it's done in diplomatic circles. There's a lot more tact probably used in diplomacy. But is there anything wrong with being, you know, if Germany thinks this, is there anything wrong with being more candid about where the country that is still going to be your partner, where you feel that they failed?
I think being candid is fine, and lots of people are candid, including in diplomatic exchanges. However, I think there's two things that I think, for one, the use by Donald Trump of, you know, the Twitter pronouncements that very often are not true or have elements in them that are not true and that put the other party on sort of their back foot in terms of trying to have a conversation about the refugee policy and about what decisions Merkel made, whether you could argue whether that was good or bad, but to question her, the legality of what she did, and to do it in that way does not, I think there's a difference between being candid and being reckless.
Yeah. And representing the complexity. I mean, that's the thing that you don't get, obviously, in Twitter.
Right.
Robert, I wonder if you have a view of what Mary is saying here.
Well, as she was saying this, I got to thinking about one very important difference between, I think, what the American electorate experiences as the world and what the European electorate experiences as the world. And I think what Germany is really up against is, I'd say a high sensitivity to what's going on around them, a very visceral and visible reaction to the influx of immigrants from Syria and from the greater Middle East, and also the failures of the economic systems or the economies all around them and having to bail out Greece and so on.
Right.
Whereas in the United States, I think there is much more insularity from all of these things. And I think as a result, someone like Donald Trump can step in and interpret what is going on and kind of steer the agenda for how people think and see the world. And this gets to be, as I think Mary just said, this borders on a recklessness because these interpretations can lead people towards very, very wrong conclusions about what is really going on in the rest of the world.
Let me come back to Sweden in just a minute. We have a call here that I think fits well with what we're talking about right now, to Shiloh in Minneapolis. Hi. What's your question or what are you thinking about?
I have an observation, actually. I'm a native Minnesotan, but I'm a British citizen as well and have lived and worked there for about a decade.
Okay.
And my experience watching the Brexit come to pass is that there are some similarities here with the U.S. in that I think there's a basic kind of economic illiteracy that people had that allowed them to buy into the magical thinking that this would fix their economic problems. When really, you know, anyone could have seen what's happening in Britain now, and especially the news today with the fall of the pound. Anyone could have seen that coming. In fact, so many people could make that case. But people, I think, were so motivated by this desire to go back to their glorious past and were acting on this really deep-rooted white supremacy that's so ingrained in that culture that they just were able to blame immigrants for their economic troubles rather than understanding, you know, that the roots of it were much more to do with wider economic policies.
You know, so, I appreciate your use of the phrase magical thinking because I think that again gets at this, what we've been talking about, which is these are such complicated and intertwined issues. And one, you know, statement about, well, I'm going to do this does not really address the level of complexity. And Mary, do you think we saw that in the Brexit vote as well? I think Shiloh is right about this.
I think that the Brexit vote was, you know, our first sort of indicator that those kind of campaigns that are not based on truth, that are based on different types of falsehoods, such as that you could leave the EU but still have all the benefits that you wanted, that were not based on economic complexity, are similar to what we're seeing here. So there's sort of two sides. There is the side of the Brexit campaigners or Donald Trump, which are putting out non-truths out there, big non-truths, like you can, you know, slap tariffs on China and won't have any blowback.
Or you can build a wall in Mexico.
Or you can build a wall and Mexico will pay for it. Yeah. Or you can leave the EU and still have free trade agreement with them. And on the receiving end, you know, I think there are enough people who feel dislocated that they were willing to take a risk on that vote without thinking it through. And so that is a similarity that I see there.
Robert, but I also want to be fair and say, you know, when I'm saying, and you can build a wall and Mexico pay for it, and, you know, the Brexit vote won't have consequences, it doesn't mean that there's only one way to approach these complex economic issues either. I don't want to undermine the we're looking for another way to do this emotion either, right? And I think that's the appeal of what the Brexit campaigners were arguing, what Donald Trump was arguing. Do you? What's your thought?
Yeah, well, it's amazing what the politics of anger can produce, right? Because you're seeing, I think, populations that are really driven by anger wanting to express it in some way, and they're using the ballot box to do it, thankfully, right? I mean, that in a sense, we should probably be grateful that the system is working in some way. It's just that it's yielding these results that have a lot of uncertainty attached to them. We really don't know what's going to happen to the United Kingdom in the post-EU age, and we really don't know, in a lot of respects, what's going to happen to the United States and the Trump administration. But we, you know, the population has spoken. You know, I mean, we have to remember that, you know, that you know, 52% of the British population voted to leave, and there's something legitimate about that. And a significant portion of the population voted in the United States to elect Donald Trump, and there's something about that. On the other hand, it's a very divided electorate as well, because we can't ignore the fact that 47 or 48% of the population wanted this to go the other way, right? And they liked things the way they were, I guess, relatively speaking. So that you also have to take into consideration. It's not just complexity in the problem, but it's also complexity in managing the problem.
Yeah. And I also want to say that to some degree, I think we can understand that voters would be drawn, Mary, to a candidate and a campaign that says, well, it hasn't been fixed for the last 30 years. And there are problems that come with the EU and some of our issues around immigration policy and all that. And when a candidate gets up and says, let's look at a new way, there may be some different ways to fix it, I can see why voters are drawn to that, of course, right?
I think absolutely that there would not have been these votes were there not people who felt and experienced lives that did not benefit from globalism. So that if you were a factory worker, if you were in, you know, a small town where, you know, you used to have a good job at Hormel or something. I read there was an article in the Star Trib yesterday about Moore County, right? So there is that in this globalization, in the EU, the unification of the EU, in the economic and political deal that came with it, there definitely were some people who were left behind. And so I think there is room for a really deep discussion about how to look at the needs of those people without, I would hope, going down the path that some, including myself, are worried about, which is not just the economic policies of, say, protectionism, but also the potential damage to democracy itself, even though Donald Trump or, you know, some of the others that are potentially going to be elected in the EU might be elected democratically, but do they respect the democratic institutions? And so it's not just the economic policies or the immigration policies or even the racism, but also the potential threat to the fundamental institution of democracy that I think is a problem that goes along with this nationalism.
It's a discussion on this Martin Luther King birthday observation day about the rise of nationalist parties and candidates in Europe. And we're taking note that there are parties and candidates in places like Sweden and Germany, and this happened in Poland and France and Austria, that are saying, look at the appeal that someone like Donald Trump, with some of his rhetoric, his protectionism, his nationalism, some of his anti-immigration rhetoric, had in the United States. What is happening here in the West? And we're trying to bring some analysis and some thought to that this morning. If you have questions about it, 651-227-6000, observations, 800-242-2828, and on Twitter at @CarrieNPR, where Raj says, can you discuss the recent rise of fake news in Europe and viral anti-Merkel, anti-immigrant false stories in online media? Robert, do you have anything to say about that? I'm really not that aware of how widespread the anti-Merkel stuff has been in Germany. Are you?
No, I can't say that I'm that aware of what's going on with fake news in the Merkel situation. But I think, as we've seen in the United States, and not just in the United States, but in Europe as well, that, again, when politics of anger are kind of ruling the day, it's very easy to slip in a story that's just going to foster and kind of accelerate that kind of anger all the more, even if it's not a confirmed allegation. Though I can't speak to what's going on in the German media environment, I know that this has been happening in Europe, and I know that it's been happening in Germany. But the extent to which it's been damaging, I'm not quite sure.
Okay. Mary, you wanted to say?
I've actually been following this a bit, and without being completely paranoid about Russia, we haven't mentioned Russia yet
right today.
And within the last couple of weeks, there has been a huge upsurge of fake news in Germany, such as, you know, a church burning someplace that did not take place, things like that, that point the finger at Merkel for the refugee policy. People who look at that very closely, like Anne Applebaum in the Washington mm-hmm. Post and others, are worried that the Russians will work to do the similar type of thing that many see having happened here in the United States.
So they're using cyber, maybe not hacking, but also
promoting fake news stories. And there's a great concern among many people who follow that. And you know, I don't think that Russia created these nationalist movements. That would be a completely wrong interpretation, but that they have seen an opportunity to fan the flames.
They figured out how to help it along.
They have. And so there has been a significant, and particularly in Germany, I don't think we've seen it yet in other countries, but in Germany, there has definitely been an upsurge.
Jessica here on Twitter is concerned that we're not calling out racism in mm-hmm. some of the rhetoric, I think both here and in Europe. She says racism is racism. Racists are racists. How can your guests have this conversation without naming racism irresponsible? Robert, I think we did say that there was an element in some of these candidates' rhetoric of racism. What else can you add to that?
Well, this is where things get really tricky, because we want to say racism. There's a lot of racist rhetoric being used here. And I think that there's some truth to that, in the sense that that in the rhetoric, a group of people is being called out for, you know, and their only crime is just being who they are, right? Mm-hmm. Or the color of their skin. And it's... it's unsettling. It's troubling. Of course, it's demonizing a whole portion of a population. And but then what happens after that is this knock-on effect of implicating a whole population on the other side of this, where it's not just Donald Trump using racist rhetoric. It's now all followers of Donald Trump are racists, right? And that they're agreeing with what he's saying. And my understanding of Trump's electorate, the ones that voted him in office, was that a lot of people did hold their nose when they voted for this man. And so they had to kind of stomach what he would say in public or the behavior that he would exhibit in certain places and times, but also, agree with one or two other points that he said. And it's very difficult to kind of pair these. There are a lot of contradictions there, and I think a lot of moral hand-wringing.
Yeah, and I want to make sure that we are not declaring everybody, obviously we're not doing this, declaring everybody that supported President-elect Trump as racist. That doesn't further the conversation, and that doesn't provide the kind of nuance that I think we have to have in these political conversations. I also, though, as Jessica raises, I don't want to miss, there is an element of that. I mean, I look at this Geert Wilders in the Netherlands. I mean, he's been tried and acquitted for inciting hatred and discrimination against Muslims. Clearly racist policies and racist beliefs there. And as Jessica notes, I don't want to miss that. Mary, if you want to add something to that.
Well, I think to go back when we started the conversation, I mentioned that in Europe, nationalism has a very ethnic identity to it.
Right.
And so Marine Le Pen and her father really very much focused on, you know, France as a nation in the ethnic sense.
Yes, yes, you said
is
that.
Is being overrun by non-French people. And that is racism, right?
Right.
So that is looking...
They're saying we can't be France if we allow those Algerians
right.
to come in and be part of the country.
And we can't be the Netherlands, and we can't be Germany. So nationalism in Europe has always had... So it's what I think is important when you're talking about nationalism is how do nationalists of that ilk use racism? And the way they use it is to point to the other. You know, you are not Dutch.
Right.
And, of course, leading up to World War II and what Nazism was about was the other was many groups, but primarily Jews, who were already inside of Germany. So it wasn't a new arrival, but rather, you know, a group that was within that was pointed to as the source of all our problems. And so now what the nationalists in Europe are doing is using that type of racism to point to the other, which is the new immigrants.
So, Anne, when you tweet, so you're Trump apologists now, isn't a vote for Trump complicit in racism. And we're going to bring information and I hope enlightened conversation and nuance to these conversations. So, no, I don't think any of us on the show today are going to say a vote for Trump means you're a racist. I think we can do better in our discussions than that. 651-227-6000 to join us this morning as we talk about this this wave of nationalist candidates in Europe and the new potential, I guess, that they have for gaining popularity and maybe leading some of their countries. 800-242-2828. When is the French election is later this year? Is it in the spring? Do you know, Robert? Or
it is later this year. I can't say exactly.
I just want to say this: there are now analysts, there political analysts there that say Marine Le Pen has a pretty good shot at winning that election. On Twitter at Carrie NPR, a look at the latest news, and on the other side, more of your calls and your questions. Hi, Phil.
Hi, Carrie. Several congressional Democrats say they will skip Donald Trump's inauguration Friday. One of them is Georgia Congressman John Lewis. He has said Russian interference in the U.S. election delegitimizes Trump's presidency. In a tweet, Trump fired back, calling Lewis's congressional district crime-ridden. The U.S. Defense Department has not commented about reports from the Middle Eastern country of Oman that it has accepted 10 detainees from the U.S. prison at Guantanamo Bay ahead of President Obama leaving office. Obama has been trying to shrink the number of detainees at Guantanamo, which he had promised to close. Three suicide bombers have attacked Nigeria's Northeastern University, killing two people, including a university professor. Authorities and witnesses say one of the bombers was a 12-year-old girl whose explosives went off when police patrolling the university shot her. Police say another blast this morning ripped through a mosque where professors were saying their prayers. Police say 15 people were rushed to hospitals. A gunman has killed at least 5 people and wounded 9 others at a nightclub at the Mexican Caribbean coast resort of Playa del Carmen. A police officer says investigators are interviewing witnesses and the motive for the shooting is not clear. The shooting happened at the Blue Parrot nightclub in Cancun, which was hosting an event that was part of a music festival. And a new Oxfam report says just 8 men own as much wealth as 3.6 billion people, about half the world. The analysis by the anti-poverty organization says the gap between the very rich and poor is far greater than just a year ago. It is urging leaders to do more than pay lip service to the problem. 4 of the 8 richest are Bill Gates, Warren Buffett, Jeff Bezos, and Mark Zuckerberg. More news ahead on NPR News. The time now is 9:41.
On our Monday, All Things Considered, the latest on the Senate confirmation process to build a Trump cabinet. And Twin Cities filmmakers head to Sundance for their movie about a mother trying to protect her sons from police shootings. I'm Tom Cran. Join me for all the day's news, weekdays starting at 3.
We have a lot of political conversations and political news planned for this week on this show. If you can't listen in real time, and I know that's tough, you got to work, you've got things to do, you've got your life to lead, you can always find it on the podcast. Just search NPR News with Carrie Miller on iTunes or wherever you listen, waiting right there for you on the podcast.
Programming is supported by Minnesota Public Radio's educational sponsors, together educating and enlightening listeners and students for generations. One of the sponsors we would like to thank is Luther College.
Back to the discussion this morning. Mary Curtin is with us from the Humphrey School. Robert Kelly is with us from American University. And I want to go back to the phones here to Lee in Moorhead. Good morning, Lee, and thanks so much for waiting. What are you thinking about here?
Well, I wanted to add another dimension to this discussion, and that is the rise of ethnic nationalism in Europe is occurring at a very particular juncture in European history. All 28 EU countries right now have fallen below replacement levels. So most countries are hovering around that 1.3 total fertility mark. And we see the rise of ethnic nationalism just at a time when the population has fallen. Take Germany, for example. The total fertility rate in Germany is 1.47. The current population of 80 million Germans is slated to fall by 20 million people by 2050, roughly, demographers estimate. I'm a sociologist. I do work in this area. So I find it peculiar that of all 28 European countries, ethnic nationalism is rising right at a time when these countries need workers. Germany will have to, by the mid-century, middle of the century, Germany will have to find roughly 500,000 workers per year just to compensate for its fallen fertility level. So I'd like your guests to talk about dimension of the discussion. And thank you so much for a wonderful discussion this morning, by the
Lee,
way.
Lee, I'm really glad you called with that. And Robert, there's the complexity of the economic, you know, problem here that I think doesn't get discussed often enough in these campaigns. What would you say to Lee about that?
Yeah, so the socioeconomic argument about what's going on in Europe has multiple dimensions to it, and I think Lee just touched on one that is a long-term concern, not just about Europe, but also just the greater West and kind of the established mainstream leaders of the world, is that there's this interesting inverse relationship between prosperity and population, that as countries become more prosperous, their reproduction rates actually fall. And, you know, more women enter the labor force. And all of a sudden, what happens is the portions of the population that are becoming the youngest and the most profligate are the minority populations that have come in from poorer parts of the world. And how does this change the racial dynamic, the demographic situation in that country? In the EU right now, Lee is absolutely right. Generally speaking, the EU is an old place. We've got an aging population, which, by the way, is also going to apply this added strain of pension, right, that all these countries are going to have to pay for people in their dotage as they get older. Who is going to put the money forward for that? It's going to be these young populations that are coming in from the outside for the most part if the incumbent populations within the EU do not leave behind a younger population on their own. So that's kind of the paradox here, is that what a lot of these countries need is a young workforce to come in and do the jobs that are going to create the productivity and the revenue that these pension programs will need.
I mean, Mary, doesn't Europe need only to look to a place like Japan to see where they're headed? if they are not more welcoming to immigrants because of what's happening with the birth rate?
Well, I think that they should look to Japan, and I think that the longer term source of some of the anxiety and the presence in Europe of migrant groups before the Syria crisis was, you know, this issue was already there.
Mm-hmm.
In the Netherlands, in France. I mean, the Le Pens have been around for a long time. And the reason that there are many migrant workers in Germany is because after the war and then continuing on as it became more prosperous was that German ethnic nationals were having fewer and fewer children. And to sustain their industrial economy, they needed to import workers. And they never tried to integrate those workers to become German.
So this is the failure on the part of these European countries that wanted the labor but were not very welcoming culturally.
Right, right. And even, you know, as much as we debate immigration here, there is a presumption in the United States that you can become American within one generation. I mean, right. I'm the daughter of an immigrant. And we see that sense that when you come here, you become American. And in Europe, they were slower to come to that realization.
Call here from Lisa in St. Paul. Good morning, Lisa. Hi.
Hi there. So I run a European networking event here in town, and I spend a lot of time with local Europeans, and I'm hearing from a lot of Europeans over in Europe, and certainly they're worried about Trump, mm-hmm. but at the same time, they're being fairly philosophical about what is happening in Europe and what's happening here. They feel like their countries had to really, really, really build up after World War II, and they worked very, very hard to rebuild. And what I think has not been mentioned is that Europeans pay enormously high taxes, mm-hmm. generally about 50%. And so as much as we want to complain about our level of taxation, theirs is really excessive. And so they're watching people who are just arriving or had arrived whenever, you know, in Germany, they still call them Gastarbeiters. You know, they were supposed to be just guest workers.
Mm-hmm.
So it was the idea that, sure, come now when we need you, but then they never left. And so it's been difficult for them, but I think by and large, the Europeans I speak to are pretty philosophical and say, this was just a matter of time. It was just going to be a matter of time with our falling birth rate and the compensation that we had to see. And so,
and you're saying many Europeans recognize that.
Yeah, yeah. And they're, you know, it's not that they're so fine with it per se, but a lot of them who are educated and more liberal are saying, yeah, this is going to happen, but there's always going to be a class or an underclass who's just very, very angry and yeah. experiencing it at a more basic level.
What's the name of the organization that you work for here, Lisa? Sounds interesting.
Well, so I started a European networking event called the Euroconnect about 5 years ago. And so we bring together Europeans and European-minded Americans or internationals in town about three times a year for networking events. Mm-hmm. And sometimes we'll have prominent European speakers who made it very big here. So
you should send me some information on that via email.
I have.
Would you do that? Oh, you already
yeah,
have.
Definitely.
Well, send it again. Yep. All right.
All right. All right. We'll
okay,
see you
good.
Soon.
Robert, I want to come back to Sweden because I don't want to miss this, because I think with our Scandinavian population around here, people think, well, Scandinavia is immune to this. I was reading some of the things that this Jimmy Akesson says as leader of the Sweden Democrats. He sounds a lot like some of the rhetoric that we're hearing in France and Germany from some of these other nationalistic parties. And he recently said this: there is a movement in both Europe and the United States where the establishment is being challenged. It is clearly happening here as well. Yeah. Is that at the bottom of this, too? It's anti-establishment in a lot of different ways.
Absolutely. One of the strains that is flowing into all this is that it's the people who have been in charge up to now that got us into this mess, because they mismanaged the influx of population. They mismanaged our economy. They sold us out to a global project which is not bringing back the dividend that we hoped for. And so, you know, what someone like Akesson is saying is, I'd say, something that is running through Scandinavia pretty rampantly right now, and also in Denmark, also in the Netherlands, and that is we're full, right? We have too many people, and so what we can do for you is give you this amount of money, or we can do these sorts of things, which sound rather crude. I mean, Sweden engaged in a project last year where they were going to just give a certain amount of money to people, and then that was basically, actually, I think I have it backwards. I think they were going to charge people to actually come to Sweden and make them pay their way, so that they could offset the cost that the state is going to incur by having them there.
Well, even though, you mean refugees or workers that were going to?
I think this applied to refugees in general. Well, okay. Obviously, I don't think it goes very far because you've got people coming into these countries that have nothing to begin with.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Call here from John in Oakdale. Hey, John, what are you thinking about?
I was struck by one of the comments made by one of the callers about the past glories of the UK.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me that one of the problems we assume the benefits of stability and, you know, gripe about, other kinds of things, just kind of take things for granted. But I wonder if there's a military component. I've heard a number of things in this country about, we used to be able to kind of push people around and dictate our will. I wonder if there's a military component to any of these issues in Europe.
Mary, what would you say?
So if I understand it correctly, is that there's a militaristic part of it or a relationship to their militaries?
John, if you're still there, I think you were saying our military
adventures.
And international policies are influencing. Let me go back to John on that. Is that right?
Right. And
okay.
Right. To be able to kind of dictate things to other countries.
Right.
So I wouldn't put it as purely military. In some of the European countries, such as the UK or France, and perhaps similarly in the United States, maybe a sense that, which was never totally true, that it used to be that we could boss people around, or it used to be we had a great empire, and now we don't. And so I think that the sense of decline that people feel is perhaps related to that.
Gail says in Grand Marais, she has a daughter who married a German. They live in Germany. Her husband has hired Afghani men who cannot speak German or write it. They're good workers fleeing crisis, and there are many Germans who want to help. And Mary, I didn't want to miss that.
Mm-hmm.
Also the case in Austria, where a lot of Syrian refugees mm-hmm. are coming into Europe, and communities are gathering around mm-hmm. to try to provide help and work and want them to integrate into their community. So I don't want to make this sound like this is all of Europe, right?
Right. And similarly, just as it's not all of the United States
exactly.
that voted for Donald Trump,
exactly.
there are wide ranges of opinion within Europe also, and there are many Europeans who do not buy into this ultra-nationalist movement. Look at Austria, just defeated a nationalist running for the ceremonial
Hofer, right?
Running for the ceremonial office of president, but nonetheless an election. And so we shouldn't look at this as a monolithic trend, and there are absolutely many Europeans, and including the Pope has taken in refugees and talked about the importance of looking at these people as coming from crisis.
You know, Robert, I was curious when I read about the research. Are you still working on that, the changing role of the diplomat?
Absolutely.
Okay, given what we're talking about this morning, I'm interested in how that's influencing the direction of your research.
Well, there are a couple of things to this. One, if I could just come back for a second and say a little bit about militarism. I think it does relate to this in some way. One thing we haven't said much about so far in this conversation is NATO and the role of NATO and as a binding force between the United States and Europe, and as also a bulwark against Russia.
Mm-hmm.
And the existence of NATO over the course of several decades now, what that's done is created a dynamic where the United States really has become the umbrella over Europe, and the military forces within Europe itself are rather weak. And so you see strange things like the UK and France having shared aircraft carriers and things like that, or you hear the price of weakness is bearing down on Europe in terms of militarism. What this, I think, means in terms of statecraft is that the United States is able to kind of maintain its in this level anyway, is able to maintain a kind of dominant voice over Europe and demand that it pays more for its security. But within Europe itself, I think you're also finding that this vacuum of weakness in terms of military strength will get, could get filled by not necessarily other military forces or private forces, but certainly by forces outside the government that are going to demand, more strength from Europe. Where my research goes with this is just to suggest that a multiplication of voices outside of the normal, the conventional diplomatic institution is also coming to the fore as we're doing this, and it just increases the traffic that is going on in both in the media and at the grassroots level.
Mary, I'm interested in your thoughts on that, having spent as many years as you did in the Foreign Service. How is the role of the diplomat going to change?
Well, I think it's a little hard to say, and I've been thinking about that because I'm teaching a course on diplomacy this semester, starting on Wednesday. And I think, for one, there always have been voices outside of the norm and that get engaged in diplomacy. But I do think that we are in a period in which we are seeing more of that. And so you have, will we see an increase, for example, in these nationalist groups to the extent, say, if they don't come into government, mm-hmm. will the governments where they do align themselves more with the parties that are not in power? Or, the whole issue of how these internet organizations play into relations among nations and diplomacy, mm-hmm. but now also how do governments then use those in the way that we think we're seeing Russia using, say, WikiLeaks? And so we are in a period, I think, in which it's very difficult to see what all those non-state players are, and that will almost certainly have an impact on how diplomats that work for their countries can operate.
I think it'd be valuable for me to come sit in on your class sometime. Can I do that?
It'd be great to have you. Yeah.
All right, good.
Yeah.
Sit in the back and listen to your wisdom. Mary, thank you. Really good to have you here.
It was great to be back.
Good luck
Thanks.
With the class starting on Wednesday, too.
Thanks.
Robert, thank you very much. And if you were nearby, I'd come sit in on your class, too.
Well, my class, not to compete here, but my class actually starts tomorrow. So you're welcome.
All right. Really good to have your insight, Robert. Thanks so much.
You're very welcome.
Robert Kelly with us from American University. Mary Curtin with us from Humphrey School.